tonight. And I wanted to let you know, I did have a lot of questions that were turned in. I think I counted 24 yesterday, which is great. And I had about 6 left over, so that gives me enough for 2 or 3 sessions. Please keep turning those in. We also have a number of people that watch our services live online and some that watch after the fact, and they email questions. And so some of the questions don't come from members here, but almost all of the questions I have tonight came from members here. Most of them are anonymous. I don't know who they came from, but we've got some good questions. I'm going to try to cover maybe 12 or 13 questions tonight. We'll watch our time and see how it goes. All right, let's just get right into it. Question number one. Early on, when you started preaching here at Willow, you mentioned a couple of study Bibles that were good sources to use. Can you mention them again, please? I failed to make a note of them and have come to realize that my study Bible explanations are not accurate to what the Bible teaches. Sure, I'd be glad to share that. This was in a sermon that I did when I first got here dealing with versions of the Bible, and I mentioned the fact that you've got to be very cautious when dealing with study Bibles because study Bibles have extra notes in them. That's the point of a study Bible. And the vast majority of these are written by denominational companies. And so what you have is basically denominational commentary that is added to the Bible. And so you've got to be very, very cautious of this. These were a few of them that were out there. The MacArthur Study Bible is a very, very popular study Bible. It is filled with Calvinism. I mentioned that, and somebody said to me recently, you know, we don't know what Calvinism is. I'm going to do a sermon about that recently, but Calvinism is basically a number of ideas. One of them is that we inherit sin from our parents, that it is passed down. You are born in sin. Another idea is that there is a limited atonement. That is, God has chosen some people to be saved and some people to be lost, and there's nothing you can do about it. You're in one group or the other. Another one is once saved, always saved as a part of Calvinism. Well, the MacArthur Bible has a lot of notes that teach that type of thing. The Tim LaHaye Prophecy Bible is filled with premillennialism, the idea that the end of time is coming very soon, there's going to be a rapture, the Lord's going to set up a throne in Jerusalem where He's going to reign for 1,000 years. The Nelson Study Bible is one of the most popular Bibles on the market, and it has a lot of denominational faith-only type error in it. So be very cautious of denominational study Bibles. Now, the question asked about good ones. I mentioned the Dixon Analytical Bible has been one of my all-time favorite Bibles. It has the King James and the American Standard in there and a lot of good study notes. I think they have stopped making it now. They stopped for a while. They started back. But I don't think it's currently available. If you can get one, it is great. I looked on eBay recently and Amazon, and they were selling for $1,200. So if you've got one, you've got a treasure. Hang on to it. The Toxin Chain Reference comes in several different versions. It is pretty good. Most of the notes in there are 99% just historical and accurate. The thing I don't like about it is massive. It is a big, heavy Bible. And my favorite one that's on the market now is the Apologetics Press Study Bible. This is put out by the brethren down at AP, Apologetics Press. It is a great, great Bible. I've got a picture of one here that is hardback. These are members of the church that produce it. They also put out a leather Bible that is very nice. I have one in my office. If you want to see it and look through it, let me know. I'll be glad to let you see that. But you can get it from Apologetics Press website. I think the leather one is about $75, which is not bad for a genuine leather study Bible. On the downside, it's also pretty big and heavy, but all of the notes in it are very reliable. All right, next question. Can you recommend a good Christian podcast to listen to? Can I recommend a Christian podcast? I'm glad you asked the question there. Yes, GBN puts out several podcasts. And if you've got an iPhone or an Android, which I suspect would be almost everybody in here, If not, if you've got a computer, you can go to the GBN website, you can go to our app, and we've got a lot of podcasts. One of our most popular podcasts is The Authentic Christian, and we've got a couple of seasons of that, so there's a lot of episodes of that. We've got the one that I do along with Aaron Gallagher, the Answering the Error, and we're in season two of that. We've got a number of different programs here that are available in podcast form. And so regardless of which way you get your podcast, maybe you get it through Spotify, maybe you get it through Apple, we have our podcast available through these various sources, or you can stream it straight from our app in video and in audio only if you prefer. We've got these that I would like to show sometime. I showed these to the teenagers this morning. I might show them in the class Wednesday night, but we are building up a library of these five-minute video series we're calling Drawn to God. This one is, do I have to be baptized to be saved? Where do we go when we die? And what must I do to be saved? It is a five-minute summary of the gospel plan of salvation, and they are very, very well done. These are also available on the app, and it's a good thing for you to share. You can go to the app and just share it with someone, put their phone number in, and send it right to them. And so it's a good evangelistic tool. So, in fact, if you want to just study a book of the Bible where you have a running commentary, you can go there to the books of the Bible and pick the book you want. And I think we've got just about, if not every book of the Bible covered now, and you can listen to a running commentary. And so it is a great thing to do, and they're all by Sound Brethren on the GBN app. And so, great question. I appreciate to whoever that was giving me the opportunity to do that plug. All right, question number three. A friend said that my Bible was missing some books in it compared to hers. How should I address this? I put this in here. Somebody has also given me a sermon request. Why do we have the books that we do in the Bible? Are we missing books of the Bible? And what about the so-called lost books of the Bible? And I think this will go very well with this question. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to do a whole sermon on this. Maybe, in fact, I'm planning right now to do it this next week if I can get it all put together. Why do we have the books we do in the Bible? If you get a Bible like is used in the Catholic Church, the Jerusalem Bible, they have quite a few additional books. Why is that? What's the explanation? We'll talk about that next week. All right, question number four. Is the Lazarus of John chapter 11 the same Lazarus of Luke chapter 16 verses 9 and following? No, this is not the same person. It seems that Lazarus was a fairly common Bible name. In John chapter 11, the Lazarus who is mentioned there is the one who is the brother of Mary and Martha. He died and he was resurrected from the dead by Jesus. John 11:35, the shortest verse in all the Bible, Jesus wept. That was at John's death. Now, the other Lazarus, the one mentioned in Luke chapter 16, is a beggar. He spent his days laid at the gate of the rich man, begging for the crumbs that fell from the rich man's table. But they are two different people, and that does confuse people sometimes. Question number five. Why do you think that Judas betrayed Jesus? What was his motivation for doing it? You know, I looked this up online just to see what theories are out there, and there's a lot of theories about this. But you know, whenever a great man or an influential man falls, it is something that is more difficult for people to understand than when somebody else falls. And you've got to appreciate that Judas was an apostle. This is a very influential man. But I want you to think about how particularly amazing this is. Here is a man who traveled with Jesus for 3 years. That means day and night he was sitting at the feet of Jesus. He was listening to his teaching. He had seen miracles. He was there at the feeding of the 5,000. He was there in John chapter 11 when Lazarus was raised from the dead. He saw demons cast out. He saw the lame made to walk again. He saw the sick people healed, maybe present for the calming of storms. We are told in the last chapter in the book of John, many other signs did Jesus, which are not written in this book, but these are written that you might believe. And so what we have is a small portion of what Jesus actually did. Who knows what all Judas witnessed? Imagine seeing that sort of thing night and day for 3 years and then turning around and betraying Jesus. That is hard to wrap your mind around. Now, the question is, how could he do it? I guess the question really is, why did he do it? I don't know the specific reason. The one thing that came to my mind, and maybe you can share some other thoughts with me, but you remember in John chapter 12, after Mary comes and anoints Jesus' feet with the very expensive oil, Judas objects. And John 12 and verse 5, Judas says, "Why was this fragrant oil not sold for 300 denarii and given to the poor?" But then verse 6 says this, "This he said not because he cared for the poor, but because he was a thief and he held the bag and he used to pilfer money that was put in." The Bible says he was greedy. He was a thief. And of course, you remember that he betrayed Jesus for 30 pieces of silver. I went back to look to see what that amounted to, and what I read says that was about 5 weeks' wages. Can you imagine that? Being with Jesus and seeing the miracles which he did. Remember, we've talked a lot in Acts class, the purpose of miracles was to confirm that he is the Son of God. He knew it. The evidence was there. The proof was there. And then he betrayed the Son of God for 5 weeks of wages. So greed, that's at least a motivating factor. The fact is, the Bible doesn't specifically say. Question number 6. Jesus prayed with the apostles at the Last Supper. Did they pray before other meals as well? Several people I know pray before they eat. Should I be doing the same, and why? Yes, when Jesus prayed with his disciples at what we call the Last Supper, that was actually the Feast of the Passover, and the Passover meal was simply a meal. Now, it had a memorial purpose, but it was simply a meal. And the Bible says, Matthew chapter 26, that Jesus gave thanks before they ate that meal. Now, did they do this at other meals? In John chapter 6 and verse 11, you've got the text there says, Jesus took the loaves, and when he had given thanks, he distributed them to the disciples, and the disciples to those who were sitting down, likewise the fish, as much as they wanted. And so there's some other accounts as well where it mentions that they gave thanks prior to eating. And so, yes, I believe we've got several examples in the Bible where Jesus or his disciples gave thanks before they ate. And certainly this is something that Christians ought to do, not just before you eat, but throughout the day. Give thanks and think about this. Teach your children to give thanks before they eat. And it is a good thing to do. It makes you reflect on the source of these blessings. And God wants us to express our appreciation to Him. Question number 7. See, we're moving along tonight. At what point did we become known as Jews and Gentiles? I did not know the answer to this question, and I had to do some digging to actually come up with this. The term Jew actually derives from the name of the tribe Judah. You remember originally the Lord's people were one kingdom. They were known as Israel. It gets to the point that there is a divided kingdom, and they split into the northern kingdom, which becomes known as Israel. The southern kingdom is primarily the tribe of Judah, and they become known as Judah. Eventually, the northern kingdom goes into Assyrian captivity, and what you're left with is the southern kingdom of Judah, and God's people came to be known as Jews, which was a derivation of Judah. The first person in the Bible chronologically to be called a Jew is in Esther chapter 2 and verse 5. That is Mordecai, the Jew. Now, if you do a search, you're going to find in the layout of the Bible, you'll find the word earlier. But chronologically speaking, the first person to be called a Jew is Mordecai. Now, the term Jew and Gentile really or the term Jew and Israelite in the Bible really are interchangeable. And so basically a descendant of Jacob, remember his name was changed to Israel, a descendant of Jacob or Israel is known as a Jew. Everybody else is a Gentile. So if you are not of Jewish descent tonight, you are a Gentile. I would venture to say that just about, if not everybody in here tonight, would be considered a Gentile. Number 8. What does the Bible say about cremation? The Bible, you know, I'm kind of thinking maybe I answered this in a question recently. I cannot remember. Maybe I just had a discussion with someone, but this was sticking in my mind. I have been asked this question many times over the years. What does the Bible say about creation? And the answer is, the Bible doesn't say anything about creation. If a person chooses to cremate a loved one, what it comes down to is a matter of personal judgment and finances. I think the reason it is, I would guess, becoming increasingly popular, or at least increasingly talked about, is because it is much less expensive. When Sherry's mom and dad passed away, we at the time had priced a funeral, and I think to bury her mother was going to be, I think they told us about $12,000, but we cremated her for less than $1,000. So at least the prices there in Mississippi at that particular funeral home, we were looking at more than 10 times as much for the funeral versus the cremation. And so it becomes a financial consideration for some people. Now, sometimes people appeal to passages like Amos chapter 2 and verse 1 or Amos chapter 6 and verse 10 to oppose cremation. I think they're really taking these out of context because these passages were condemning not the practice of cremation, but rather a callous desecration of a body. If you look at 1 Samuel chapter 31, you've got the men of Jabesh-Gilead who took the body of Saul and his sons, and they burned them for the purpose of keeping them out of the hands of the Philistines, and it was done as a matter of respect. And so what you have there is cremation practiced as a matter of respect, a good thing. And so what it comes down to today is purely a matter of judgment, a matter of finances. Some people find it objectionable. Sherry and I were talking about this, and she said, I just can't stand the idea of being put in that box and burned. And I said, you won't know it. You won't know it when that happens. And so it is one of those type things. For some people, it is just a better thing to do financially. Other people think, you know, somebody said to me one time, is it wrong? And I said, why would it be wrong? And she said, well, it seems like it's going to be a problem on the day of judgment. It will not be a problem on the day of judgment. Remember, the Lord who made us from the dust of the ground is not going to have a problem creating or raising man. 1 Corinthians 15 says, flesh and blood shall not inherit the kingdom of God. The resurrected body is not going to be the same as this flesh and blood body anyway. All right, good question. Next question. In class, you talked about praying to the Godhead, specifically praying to Jesus. What about singing songs like Just a Little Talk with Jesus? And what about Jesus is Coming Soon? The song Just a Little Talk with Jesus is really nothing more than the sinner's prayer put to music. Listen to this. This is straight out of the song. I once was lost in sin, but Jesus took me in. And then a little light from heaven filled my soul. It bathed my heart in love and wrote my name above. Now listen. And just a little talk with Jesus made me whole. The idea of this song is I prayed to Jesus, and that fixed everything. It made me whole. In fact, if you go on through the song, it gets even worse. The Bible does not teach that I was lost in sin and I could talk to Jesus or pray to Jesus and it makes me whole. The Bible never teaches salvation by prayer. The Bible teaches that if a man is going to be saved, a person is going to be saved, it's going to be by obedience to the gospel plan that God has laid out. Now, it also mentions, what about the song Jesus is Coming Soon? I don't want to embarrass anybody by bringing this up. In fact, I sang this song for years before I had any idea what this song was about. When you hear this song, it gets in your head. And it is one, when you hear it, you will have it running through your mind for days after that because it is such a catchy tune. Listen to the words of this psalm. Troublesome times are here, filling men's hearts with fear. Troublesome times will soon be o'er, happy forevermore. Jesus is coming soon. I'm not reading the whole song. The next verse says, when these signs come to pass. What signs? Well, the troublesome times. We've got trouble going on in this world. The idea is, this is a sign. The end is coming. You look at the wars and the rumors of wars and the things going on in the Middle East, all of these troubles are signs that Jesus is coming soon. The next verse I mentioned, when these signs come to pass, nearing the end at last, Jesus is coming soon. This song was written by a man who is a premillennialist, and the doctrine of premillennialism says that when we get close to the end of time, that really bad things are going to start to happen. Troublesome times are here. And then these signs are going to be an indicator that Jesus is coming soon. When these signs come to pass, we're almost there, nearing the end at last. These are signs that Jesus is coming soon. Now, some songbooks in the Brotherhood have actually changed it a little bit. They've taken out the second verse to make it less objectionable. When these signs come to pass, nearing the end at last. But the fact is, even if you take that out, the first verse still teaches troublesome times are here. Now, it says troublesome times are here, filling men's hearts with fear. Freedom we all hold dear now is at stake. You look at all the trouble going on right now, and we're in big trouble. Jesus is coming soon. But did you know if you could go back and you read Matthew chapter 24, troublesome times have always been here. In fact, the world is maybe having less trouble than it did at many points in the biblical history. You think back to times like Sodom and Gomorrah and some historical events that I could reference in the Bible, and you would see that troublesome times are not a new thing. You know, is Jesus coming soon? I don't know. I could just as equally sing Jesus is not coming soon as I could Jesus is coming soon, because the fact is Matthew chapter 24 tells us we do not know when Jesus is coming. Matthew 24 and verse 36 says, but of that day and hour knoweth no man, no, not the angels in heaven, but my Father only. And then he goes on to say, as it was in the days of Noah, and he describes Noah's situation. In those days, men are going to be getting married and going to work and giving in marriage, and they're not going to have any clue. There's no indicators. There's no sign until the day that, bam, like a thief in the night, the Lord will return. And so the message of the song is premillennialism. All right, question number 10. What is an idle word? Can you give some examples if possible? Go in detail if possible. Matthew 12 and verse 36, Jesus said, but I say unto you that every idle word that men shall speak, they shall give an account thereof in the day of judgment. An idle word here doesn't mean what we normally think of as an idle word. When we think of an idle word, we think of just careless, innocent, you know, silly, joking, that sort of thing. That's not what this is talking about. This isn't saying you can't joke and you can't cut up or be silly with your family or something like that. Rather, this refers to a wickedness, malicious words, slanderous words. Next to Matthew 12:36, you can write Ephesians 5:4, and this will explain it. It says, let there be no filthiness, nor foolish talk, nor crude joking, which are out of place. 2 Corinthians 12 and verse 20 gives us some ideas of the type of words here that might get you into trouble. It mentions this, quarreling. See, you get angry and you're fighting and you're going to say these angry words to each other. Jealousy, anger, hostility, slander, gossip, conceit, disorder. Those are all from 2 Corinthians 12, 20. So it says, can you get specific if possible? Backstabbing people. would fall into this category. He is such a loser. That's going to be that. Mean, malicious talk, gossip. Did you hear so-and-so about Sam? Did you hear what John did? Crude humor, nasty sexual talk, outburst of anger. You get so angry you just blurt out some hostility from 2 Corinthians 12 and verse 20. Slander, bad-mouthing people. You know, we got the sorriest preacher, and you know, that's my favorite one. Complaining, ingratitude, lying. In fact, listen to this. This is really the root of it. Matthew 12, 34, this is the context in which Jesus makes this statement. Matthew 12, 36, he says, every idle word that men shall speak, they'll give an account thereof in the day of judgment. Matthew 12, 34 sets the stage. Jesus says, for out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. A good man out of the good treasure of his heart brings forth good things. An evil man out of the evil treasure brings forth evil things. What's the point? He is saying the words that come out of your mouth are a reflection of your heart. And so if you've got a corrupt heart, it's going to be obvious because you can judge a person by their fruit, right? And so the fruit, the words that you speak, give you an insight to a person's soul. You can see a person's heart by the things they do and by the things that they say. All right, question number 11. I've heard a preacher say that if a man in a congregation meets all the qualifications of an elder and he wishes to be one, then the current eldership does not have scriptural authority to tell him he cannot be part of the eldership. Is that accurate? No, I don't think that's accurate. You know, 1 Peter 5 and verse 2 commands an eldership to feed the flock of God which is among them, taking the oversight thereof. And so an eldership is going to oversee a congregation. They're going to make judgments that is best for that congregation. And I thought about this. Is it the case that any time a man becomes qualified that he can tell the other elders, you've got to let me be an elder now because I'm qualified. You don't have any choice in this. Think about this. If the eldership hasn't approached him and said, we think you're qualified, we want you to serve, then who made up their mind that this man's qualified? Apparently, this man decided of his own accord that he is qualified. And so I think you can see the problems with that. Imagine this. What if a congregation were blessed to have 60% of the men in that congregation who were qualified to be elders? That would be a rare thing. But if that were the case, must we make all of those men elders? That might be problematic. I do not believe it's the case that every qualified man should be ordained necessarily to be an elder. Now, on the flip side of this, it could be that an eldership might have some selfish or unseemly motive that they say, we don't want any more elders. Maybe they're lording over the flock. Maybe they don't want to jeopardize their power. And that could be a different matter altogether. But just because a man is qualified, I don't know anything in the scripture that says he must be forced or force his way in to be an elder, has to be an elder. Question number 12. This one's kind of long. I might make this the last question. Even the question's long. What should a Christian do if their employer starts publishing a commercial with a gay couple? What if the company prints two men in their flyers or two women on something they use for advertising? This has not happened yet for me. I'm just wondering what your thoughts are on the Christian's response. Do you continue working for that company or do you quit? A coworker of mine with a second job has to change out monthly posters, and they always have two men or two women with a rainbow flag behind them. She struggles with this each month, and I fear it's something that we're going to see more and more of. I think so too, probably. And this person says, I would appreciate your insight. You know, questions like this get tricky because it becomes a matter of where do you draw the line on this? You know, companies today, practically every company supports homosexuality to some extent. And so what if there's some company policy that they say, we're just okay with it? Where do you draw the line? What if this company has a poster put up in the back of their store? You know, Walmart's got a poster put up in the back of the store. Does that mean you can't work there? What if they want you to hang the poster? Can you work there? What if they want you to design the poster or to put together the advertising campaign? Do you see how this gets progressively worse depending on where you draw the line on this? And so I think the first thing that comes into play here is going to be a matter of conscience. Romans chapter 14 teaches that there are some things about which the Lord would not necessarily condemn, but it might bother. Now, He condemns homosexuality, don't get me wrong, but there are some things that might not be wrong in and of themselves, but they might be wrong because it bothers your conscience. And if you offend your conscience, you would be sinning. That's Romans chapter 14, verse 23. So where do you draw the line on this? I think 1 Corinthians chapter 8 and 1 Corinthians chapter 10, the Lord gives us a scenario that is there for the purpose of helping us make decisions like this. In 1 Corinthians chapter 8, He's discussing eating meat that has been sacrificed to an idol, and then it's sold in the marketplace. And so it might be something like this. Maybe you've got the Temple of Diana, and they sacrifice all this meat to Diana. When they get done, they sell all the extra meat to the market. And then people go to the market and they just buy this meat. 1 Corinthians 8 and verse 4 says, concerning the offering of concerning of eating things offered to the idol, we know that an idol is nothing in this world and there is no God but one. That is to say, if you go to the marketplace and here's a piece of meat and you buy it, it was previously offered to an idol. You didn't participate in the worship. You weren't in the temple. You just bought it in the marketplace. He said, you can eat it. There's nothing wrong with that. You didn't participate in that in any way. All right? Verse 7 says, however, there is not in everyone that knowledge. For some, with consciousness of the idol, until now, they eat it as a thing offered to an idol. Their conscience, he says, being weak, is defiled. And so he says, in and of itself, it's not wrong to eat that. But imagine that you are a Christian. Maybe you just came out of idolatry. You were a Gentile. You used to worship Diana. And so this meat's been offered, and you know it. And you see it, and you think, oh, I can't eat that. He says, if you do it anyway, you sin. And so this brother eats it, and it's not sin. This brother eats it, and it is sin. See, it's not in and of itself a matter of right and wrong, but conscience comes into play. All right, you keep going. Verse number 9, he says, but beware lest somehow this liberty of yours becomes a stumbling block to them that are weak. Here's a third thing. You've got to consider other people. You don't want to be a stumbling block to other people. All right, now, chapter 10, he gives us some more guidelines. Verse 14 says, therefore, my beloved, flee from idolatry. Don't make it look like you're a part of idolatry. Don't participate in it. Verse 25 says, eat whatever is sold in the meat market, asking no question for conscience sake. He says, for the earth is the Lord and all of its fullness. So you go to the marketplace, they're selling meat. You can buy the meat. Take it home, you can eat it, an idol is nothing. Now listen to verse 27. If any of those who do not believe, a non-Christian, invites you to dinner, he says, go, eat whatever is set before you, asking no questions for conscience sake. So an unbeliever, a non-Christian says, hey, we work together, come over to my house and eat dinner. You say, sure, I'll do that. You get there, they serve you some meat, eat the meat. Don't ask it, don't say, where'd you get this meat? Just eat the meat, you're okay. Then he says, but if anyone says to you, this was offered to an idol, he says, do not eat it. For the sake of the one who told you, and for conscience sake, he says, conscience I say, not yours, but for the other. That is, you don't want to give the impression to this unbeliever that you support this and that you are going to participate in this meat offered to an idol. So what do you get from all that? You say, Don, that's a lot of stuff. What do you get from this? First, you can't directly support sin. Flee idolatry. If you are removed from it, disconnected from it, such as buying the leftovers in the market, then you need to consider your own conscience. Thirdly, you've got to think about your influence and other people. That is, I don't want to be a stumbling block to other people. I don't want to give the impression that I support this sin. You know, I might have shared this with you before, but when I was in the military on one occasion, we were going to have a picnic or some kind of meal. I don't remember what it was, but they said to me as a low-ranking E4, they said, go and get the beer for the gathering. And I said, no, I'm not going to get the beer. Now, somebody might have said, why? You know, you weren't going to be drinking it. It's not like that. And people understand, I did not want anyone to see me getting beer. I didn't want them to think I endorsed beer. I didn't want them to think that I was okay with it in any way, shape, or form. And so I said, no. And they said, all right, you go get the potato chips. I said, all right, I can't get the potato chips. So I did that. Now, I went to the picnic. I didn't drink a beer. Now, what was the distinction? One, I felt like would have bothered my conscience. If someone had seen me, I had this direct connection that it might have been a stumbling block. I might have looked to be endorsing it. But when I went to the picnic, they knew it was a required function. They knew that I wasn't drinking the beer. I stayed away from it. I felt like I was detached from this. Now, I know this is a long way to answer the question, so what about the job and the posters? Number one, you can't directly support homosexuality. I could not be involved in the marketing campaign for the purpose of doing this. Now, what about it being in the store? I work in Walmart or wherever, and on the back wall there's a poster of two men together and a rainbow. I think that becomes a matter of conscience. I could work in that store. No one is going to come in and think, hey, Don supports homosexuality. I saw that poster on the back wall. Nobody's going to conclude that. And so I'm considering my influence, the effect it's going to have on other people. Now, if they ask me to make the posters, to distribute the posters, to be a part of the campaign, I'm not going to do that because it supports, it promotes it, which is the whole point of the campaign, right? And for the sake of others and for my influence and for the reflection on the Lord's church, I'm not going to take part in this. So 1 Corinthians 8, 1 Corinthians 10, I think have been put there so that we can glean from these principles to help us answer questions such as these. All right, I'm going to stop there tonight. Thank you for the questions. I appreciate those so very much. We always like to extend the Lord's invitation because there might be someone who needs to obey the gospel. Maybe you are here and you need to become a Christian. The Bible teaches the way an individual becomes a child of God, is added to the church, becomes a Christian, is by obeying the gospel, hearing, believing, repenting, confessing, and being baptized. If you want to do that tonight, we are always ready to assist you. Maybe you're here as a Christian. Maybe you have sin in your life that's public. You desire the prayers of your brethren, and we are always honored and glad to do that as well. Tonight, if you need to respond to the Lord's invitation, you've got the opportunity. We invite you to come as together we stand and sing the invitation song.